في شأن الترسيم نؤكد.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed, and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life, life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men boarded a flight to Italy on August 31st. But al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar Gaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
The Iranian Foreign Minister's short notice visit to Russia carries major messages, as it comes at a time when Tehran is carefully examining the recent U.S. draft response to the 2015 deal, which holds Russia as one of its signatories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was warmly greeted in Moscow on Wednesday by his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The Russian Foreign Minister once again reaffirmed his country's support for a fair deal or no deal.
The Russian Federation shares the same stances as Iran towards the 2015 deal. We believe that the U.S.'s illegal sanctions against Iran must be removed to save the deal.
Meanwhile, Tehran and Washington are currently exchanging comments on the European Union's new draft proposal for the revival of what is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has repeatedly said it wants a sustainable accord, which includes guarantees that would make the deal immune to any possible withdrawal by the U.S. administration.
My colleagues are thoroughly reviewing the American text. We seek stronger and more reliable guarantees from the U.S. to prevent any future withdrawal from the deal by the U.S. government.
The 2015 deal was cast into limbo in 2018 when Washington unilaterally walked out of the accord and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Iran, in return, scaled back some of its commitments to the pact, saying it will return to its obligations only after the U.S. removes all anti-Iran sanctions. The Vienna talks over the revival of the accord have faced a hiatus over the past 5 months. The discussions are now set to resume after Iran approves and accepts the U.S. draft response.
The Iranian foreign minister's visit to Moscow is of great significance, since Russia is a key player in the 2015 deal and shares Iran's stance in the accord. Now, while the United States' response to the EU draft proposal is still under examination in Tehran, here, Sergei Lavrov says Russia will accept nothing less than Tehran's full rights under the agreement. Yusuf Jalali, Moscow.
On the 30th of August last year, the last of the U.S. troops hastily left Kabul International Airport, marking the end of a two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. On its anniversary, the people of Afghanistan are celebrating this occasion. They say being independent and free from any occupation is a great blessing for the nation.
This is a victorious day for Afghans. 1 year ago, the U.S. occupying forces were forced to leave Afghanistan. Of course, they were defeated against the will of our people. We are proud that another invasion failed in our country.
most Afghan people believe the U.S. invasion brought them nothing but more conflict, poverty, destruction, and suffering. They say today it is Afghans who are in charge of their own country and that they should work to build their homeland.
In the past 20 years, we didn't witness anything except bombardments, destruction, and civilian casualties. People across the country were busy burying their loved ones every day.
We have gathered here to mark Afghanistan's independence from the U.S. occupation. Last year, on this day, the U.S. withdrew from our country. We are happy that the U.S. is no more present here. But unfortunately, our country is reeling from economic problems. I hope the new rules of Afghanistan provide job opportunities and protect the rights of all Afghans.
Participants also called on the U.S. to learn from its past mistakes and stop the ongoing ill policies towards Afghanistan and its people. 1 year on, Afghans are celebrating the U.S. withdrawal from their country. People here say they are happy that the U.S. invasion was ended because they were exhausted by Americans' gross violations. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
England's healthcare service workers receiving national praise for staying in the job through the grueling days of the pandemic to save lives. An increasing number of them, doctors, nurses, and midwives, have either quit the service or are actively considering to do so.
Profits have risen by 35% in the UK since the pandemic. More money to the rich, but not to those that are sick or for people that care for them.
The most recent culprit, poor pay. Rejecting a 4% pay increase in the face of soaring inflation, they're set to vote for industrial action.
Even with all those budgeting, we are still struggling. And so what would help in the NHS really was to increase our salary like everybody else is getting bonuses. We are not. Why? Why is this? And if you're not going to increase our salary, at least do something about transportation or even the parking. We can't be paying for things like this. It's ridiculous.
There are other reasons, too, for the exodus. A recent survey by union-led With NHS Staff campaign found stress, burnout, a feeling of abandonment after the pandemic. Some are having to use food banks or sleep inside hospitals. And it doesn't stop there.
There were other abuses of staff which made themselves clear, which also manifested. And actually, a large part of the nursing workforce who want to learn also cite discrimination. And there's a large amount of bullying, harassment, intimidation, discrimination that goes hand in hand with not every environment within the NHS, but within certain environments.
More people leaving the NHS means more work to be done by those who stay while they wait for the tens of thousands of vacancies across the country to be filled. A negative spiral hard to overcome in addition to the cost of living crisis. And then there's the years of underfunding and a wholesale drive to privatization, regardless of which party is in power.
The plan to privatize the NHS is not piecemeal. It's wholesale. I'm afraid Labour and Tory are like this. There isn't a fundamental difference in their attitude. We're already facing a winter bed crisis now. It's August, okay? And it's only going to get worse through the winter. So there is an under-provision in order to force people who can't get adequate care from the NHS into the private sector.
Created after World War II by a Labour government, the NHS is a publicly funded healthcare system, free at the point of need. Decades later, though, it's facing acute staff shortages, underfunding, and rapid privatization, which means that the crown jewel of Britain's public healthcare provision may soon be no more. Saipur is up, London.
Pakistan is racing against time to prevent further loss of life and accelerate aid deliveries to those affected by relentless monsoon rains and devastating flooding, which have led to a staggering number of casualties and caused billions of dollars in damage. Fears of flooding around the riverbanks prompted thousands from north to south to flee their homes, with some living on highways with their livestock, miles away from their flooded villages and towns. Many still are not ready to leave their houses underwater.
Our houses have been washed away with floods,
with everything we had. We have nothing to lose now. We are living in miserable conditions and waiting for help from the government.
Millions of Pakistanis affected by the worst flooding in a decade are in desperate need of aid. Thousands are living in temporary shelters. As the authorities say, they have been overwhelmed by the scale of the disaster.
We evacuated people from low-lying areas. Almost around 50,000 people were evacuated within a span of 10 hours. The relief side is ongoing. The district administration is providing meals, medicines, lodging, and all other facilities.
Press TV's crew visited a flood-hit region on the bank of River Kabul in Nowshera district of one of the worst-hit provinces of Pakistan, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Powerful flash floods caused the Kabul River to swell, sweeping away bridges overnight, cutting off the local population from road access. However, rescue workers say that they have managed to save the lives of thousands of residents thanks to early evacuations.
We remain successful in preventing life losses as our rescue teams make it possible to evacuate people before the flood water hits the nearby population on the bank of River Kabul. Now we are trying to deliver food via boats to the people who are still stranded in flood water.
Relief camps have been established by the Pakistani government in various parts of the country for flood victims. However, many remote regions are still waiting for rescue teams.
The remains of the flood show the intensity of the disaster that broke the record of past 30 years. An estimate suggests that over 33 million people are affected by the tragedy. The future of those who are displaced are in limbo, as nobody knows how and where they will rebuild their lives. Nasir Kazmi, Nowshera district of northwestern Pakistan.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth.
and who took no helper when he authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing him. Terence fall low in awe of him. Faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the West, in particular the U.S., Iran has always pursued a policy independent of Washington. As such, there have been clashes of ideologies. Iran has not been subservient to the U.S. and has not become a vassal state. This explains why Iran's leader has hailed the Islamic Republic as the most promising force in the face of plots pursued by colonial powers, stating that most of their outrageous demands have been resisted and rejected due to Iran's resistance. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what kinds of demands the leader was talking about and why those demands and pressures have failed. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille in France. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Sid Mohsin Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Sid Mohsin Abbas, first to you. One of the things that Iran's leader has said, Shia Muslims take great pride in standing up against arrogant powers which interfere in the affairs of other countries, governments, and nations in a cruel and tyrannical manner. Can you expand that for us, please?
Well, lying at the heart of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran, is an ideology. And this is what quite often both Western analysts, as well, those Western analysts who are antagonistic towards Iran, and Western politicians and Western media very conveniently forget that the Islamic Revolution was based on not only bringing down the arrogant powers as manifested by the Shah of Iran, but it's also based on some fundamental values, the values of justice, the values of courage, and the values of fairness. These are just some of the values which, of course, Islam, which is at the heart of the Islamic Revolution's ideological stand, insists upon. And the leadership of Imam Khomeini, followed by the guidance of Rehber-e Mukawama, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has kind of consolidated around these fundamental values. And when Ayatollah Khamenei, therefore, talks about the enmity of the arrogant powers, what he's talking about is a fundamental flaw in the system that lies certainly in the West, and that flaw is based on the lack of virtues, and the key one he picks out there is arrogance, and it is this arrogance which leads the West to try and subjugate Iran, which is its primary objective, by any means necessary. So subjugating Iran, of course, means economically, politically, ideologically, and they go about doing it through, and they have done it, through military means, through economic sanctions, and they've tried it through psychological operations, cultural wars. All of it has been rolled out, and we can go into more of the details of how that's been done.
Sure.
And I think this is what Ayatollah Khamenei is talking about, that Iran's defense of against that constant attack from all different forms has been a very successful one.
Okay. When we take a look at the way that Iran is actually viewed, Elijah Magnier, by the West, and in particular the U.S., obviously the U.S. has problems with Iran and what it stands for. Taking a close look, however, at what Iran stands for is not something that is out of the ordinary or is something outrageous. We're looking at, again, some of the statements made today, another which is about standing up to bullying, where Iran's leader described Iran's encouragement of other nations to stand up against bullying as the main reason behind what he said was arrogant power's wrath and enmity towards the Islamic Republic. What types of things do you think Iran's leader is talking about when he says standing up to bullying?
Well, actually, the Americans really don't care about
the religion in Iran or in any other country, and they really are careless about the Sunni or the Shia or any other religion. They are mainly concerned about the country that is submitted to the U.S. hegemony or not submitted to the U.S. hegemony. And Iran, since 1979, showed that it is rejecting the U.S. or any other hegemony, even the Russian or any other country that is trying to impose its will on the Iranian population. So from that on, from that period onward, for America, Iran become an enemy state or a state to be you have to be breaked and bring to submission, and Iran should kneel to the American hegemony of the world, particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union. Iran remained with a very few countries like Cuba, and after that, many years later, Venezuela, who are rejecting the U.S. hegemony. So from that on, the Americans constructed 35 military bases around Iran in different countries in the Gulf. They even pushed Saddam Hussein to attack Kuwait through the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad. And they attack Iraq to cripple Iraq, but at the end of the day, to be on the border with Iran, because the aim was to submit Iran after Syria and Lebanon. So this is how the Americans understand how countries should function. And countries should function according to the U.S. policy and putting the U.S. Priority above any other priorities, including the national security of any country. We've seen this today happening in Europe. So it is not surprising that the Americans consider Iran as an enemy. The only thing that the Americans want from Iran is just to accept its hegemony, and then Iran can be the leader of all the nations in the Middle East. And that would be extremely happy for the Americans to do, as long as Iran submits to the Americans. And we've seen today with the nuclear deal, Iran is showing that its national interests come first and not the U.S. hegemony.
So following that train of thought, Saeem Hossein Abbas, we're looking at the fact that the U.S. Throughout the decades since the Islamic Revolution has not been able to obviously make Iran subservient to its foreign policy objectives, particularly in this region. And it has subscribed to something that has really reared an ugly head way back, and it showed itself back in 2003 particularly, and that's the whole issue of sectarianism when the U.S. waged a war against Iraq. Tell us the way that the U.S. used that card, and how what kind of function did Iran have in that to basically defeat the consequences that arose out of that U.S. push?
Well, this notion of a Shia crescent popped up quite early on in this century, perhaps even slightly before. And initially it was the Jordanians and the Arabs who were aligned to the Americans who started pushing this idea of a Shia crescent. And that was the first time one heard of this kind of new narrative that was being pushed out ultimately by American intelligence agencies and all those that were allied to them. And it was really designed to create a fear, first of all, amongst Sunnis. So there was this sectarian effort to divide the Middle East along Shia and Sunni lines, and they went for it, and they still continue to go for it. It's, of course, it's kind of most vicious and venomous manifestations, of course, are Daesh and ISIS, who are well known across the world now to have been a kind of head-cutting, very ruthless, very, very, very nasty phenomena, which was actually on the verge of bringing Iraq down. It was certainly operating and still is operating to bring Syria down. It still is doing the same with Iraq. Those are just two theaters of its operation. Afghanistan, I could quote, perhaps even Libya and Yemen as well. But primarily, it's Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, its support of Hezbollah and its support of Assad in Syria, its support of Iraq in terms of trying to make sure that it has sovereignty, or these nations or these regions have their own sovereignty, which has actually prevented the American plots and plans to use Daesh, to use ISIS as a means of breaking the region. But at the heart of it was ISIS was handed an ideology. It was handed a kind of very extreme, very violent version of Wahhabism, which originates, of course, in those same Arab states which are propped up by the Americans and who are supported by them, like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, you know, all of these central nations, which all supported this nasty virus known as Daesh. But of course, it's failed largely because of the military actions of the Al-Quds force and many other reasons. But the Iranians have also countered with their own, of course, ability to be able to show people that there's another way. And the way is a successful model of Velayat-e Faqih, a successful model of Iran, which can actually challenge the hegemony.
Well, taking a look at this sectarian card, Elijah Magnier, it seems like something that they went for was the fact that they wanted to use sectarian tensions to ultimately try to divide the two, Sunnis and Shias, and to form an ethnic mapping, of which we heard that echoed by the now U.S. president, but former VP of the U.S., Joe Biden, when he went for the partition of Iraq. Was that a concerted effort by the U.S. to ultimately partition Iraq, as stated in the past by then VP of the U.S., Biden?
Well, the Americans failed to confront Iran and its allies in the Middle East. Therefore, it was in need of another enemy that can fight Iran and can fight all the allies of Iran without the U.S. interfering in the middle of the battle, but supplying from behind and allowing groups to fight each other by triggering the reason behind that. So the problem in the Twelvers is they stand against injustice. And the Sunnis in general, they obey to the rulers. By having a group of people who stand against injustice, they are extremely dangerous because what the Americans are bringing to the Middle East, they are bringing dominance and they're bringing death and destruction and control. This is what they've done in Afghanistan for 20 years. This is what they've done in Iraq. And then in Iraq, they have failed. So the only way is to turn the Shia and the Sunni against one another. And we've seen in Iraq how the Shia resisted for many years not to respond to the extremist Sunni who are not really Sunni, but they have a particular ideology that was exploited by the Americans. I remember Colin Powell saying that they have boosted the image of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who lived in Kurdistan before 2003, under the control of the U.S. forces. So they were very much aware of the weight of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, what he represented, and they inflated him because they needed him to confront the Shia. And this is what they've done in Syria, by trying to blur the real narrative by saying that it is a sectarian war when 70% of the Syrian army are Sunni fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And then we suddenly see, to prove the fake narrative of the Americans, that they claim it is Sunni Shia, when we've seen ISIS attacking Al-Qaeda, and they're both Sunni, both Wahhabis, and they both believe more or less in the same doctrine. So all this excuse by the Americans to bring the Islamophobia or the Shia phobia, or to bring the Sunni and the Shia together, has only one aim. It's a political aim, it's not a religious aim. But they found ground for that, and they supported, and they threw oil on fire, and they found who can listen to them, particularly when we see how the Americans supported Al-Qaeda in Syria, to understand that the objective of the Americans is not to defeat the extremists, but to support them as long as they serve their own objectives and purposes.
Well, it's very interesting the way that the whole approach of the U.S., Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, has been towards the terrorists that are Sunni. And I'm going to read off what I found to be something that was echoed on numerous sites. This one is from the Atlantic Council in a report where it said U.S. made Iran the U.S.'s top priority in the Middle East, allowing for America's great big counter Sunni extremist machine. Now notice, it doesn't call them, the U.S. doesn't call them terrorists. It calls them Sunni extremist machine, to shift focus to Shia groups. And it goes on to say, Iranian-backed Shia militant groups have begun to be sanctioned more regularly, even those that had fought against Daesh. Now, can you believe that? It says the Shia groups who are fighting against Daesh, they're still terrorists. Can you please explain the logic there?
Well, there is no logic there. As we've recognized, that America has a very one-sided and very single-minded objective. It is to crush the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership and its kind of governance structures until it actually does what America says, until it hands over its wealth, it hands over its sovereignty, hands over all of its kind of autonomy. The Americans and the Israelis, for that matter, won't rest. And of course, you know, it's not just the card of the Shia Sunni that they've tried to play, because of course they know that Islamic Republic of Iran is predominantly Shia, although there's a very peaceful Sunni minority that lives in that region. There's a peaceful Jewish minority that lives there as well. But what they've tried to do is isolate Iran and try to create a propaganda that Iran is Shia, and it can never therefore be a leader of the Islamic world or the Western Asia, because it's fundamentally religiously different. Although the differences between the Shia and Sunni are absolutely minuscule in reality. Anybody who knows anything about religious depths knows that that's a fallacy to create that kind of level of division. But they've also used the Arab non-Arab card, don't forget. And with, again, Iranians and the whole notion of Persia and whatever, they've tried to also use that to accentuate the difference of Iranians from the Arabs. They've tried to create intra-Shia conflicts, as you talked about, intra-Sunni conflicts and the wars that have been going on between those groups and the parties. I mean, Libya was not a Shia-Sunni crisis. Again, it had a completely different dynamic. Syria was nothing to do with that. But this intra-Shia fighting, they've sponsored certain groups within Iran and outside Iran. Imam Khamenei has said very clearly that British Shiism, i.e. Western manufactured Shiism or religious ideology, is also a factor. And they use this largely as a psychological operation, you know, using the media. This is very, very, they're very clever at this. The US satellite media has hundreds and hundreds of propaganda platforms to advertise against Iran, to pump up the public against the Islamic Republic of Iran, to say that it's failing, that it isn't able to handle itself in a sort of a civilized way. This is all part of the propaganda that's also been going on. They've used every means necessary to try and really isolate Iran in that sense.
Well, that's the whole thing that Iran's leader was also talking about, in addition to what we've covered, Elijah Magnier, and that's the whole notion of Iranophobia. Of course, that's been going on for quite some time. But it's interesting the way that the U.S., if you can expand on this for us, if you agree, has created this Iranophobia as a tool to generate money. We know that the U.S. is always after vilifying a country, and, well, Iran's been on that list, maybe in the number one spot for quite some time. We're in the region, Iranophobia through the U.S. has generated billions of dollars in military sales. Doesn't that hold true?
Yes, it is true, because creating Iranophobia with the support of the countries of the Middle East, particularly the Gulf countries, the U.S. has succeeded in implementing this Iranophobia in the leadership among the Arabs to push them to buy more weapons and to allow more military bases in the country. So this is how the Americans managed to implant military bases around Iran, under the excuse of Iran creating a danger, potential danger, when Iran never attacked any Arab country since 1979. So if we look, I mean, we should not be surprised here in the West to look at Iran supporting the Palestinian Sunni in Gaza, supporting the Syrian and President Assad, where the majority are Sunni, supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, supporting Iraq, and particularly when General Qasem Soleimani first supported the Kurd in Kurdistan, and then the Sunnis in Al-Anbar and the Shia in the south and in Baghdad, and then supporting the people in Venezuela. So we understand that Iran has gone beyond the religion, and that is extremely dangerous to the American objective and plans in the world. Today, the Americans are fighting the Russian and the Chinese for their hegemony. So Iran is standing in the way, giving an example for the last 43 years. And this is how the Americans manage to create this fear among the Arabs, to tell them that the Iranians have are expansionists, and they are expanding to other countries, and they will come and take your country. It is not possible, because this is only a fool person can believe that, because the Americans tried to occupy Afghanistan, and they have 1,800,000 soldiers, and they failed. They tried to occupy Iraq, and they have failed. They tried to occupy Syria. Again, they failed. They went to, with the multinational forces in the 80s in Lebanon, and they were kicked out. So no country can go and invade another country and be able to occupy the entire country and stay there forever. So this Iranian phobia has been also used by the Gulf country leaders to support the Americans and buy their weapons so they can keep the danger of the American away from them.
And final question, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas. The U.S. Its allies have, particularly the U.S., have called Iran a destabilizing actor in the region, that it's creating instability. How ironic that Iran delivered a message from an anonymous European leader to Russia to mediate between Russia and Ukraine to find a solution, when the U.S. is pushing, and its European allies pushing, for the war to continue in Ukraine. That doesn't sound like Iran being a bad actor.
Well, I think if you look at the track record of what goes on in the Middle East, all of the wars that have been begun in that region have an American hand behind them sooner or later, if you follow the paper trails and the money trails. If you look at the one-sided treaties which America signs in the region, favoring Israel with its nuclear weapons, favoring Saudi Arabia with its nuclear policies, for instance, where they're actually offering them a nuclear capability in one shape or form. Looking at the way America goes and interferes in the places like Iraq with the lies of the WMDs, which sure, turned out to be non-existent. Look, there's an absolute litany of evidence to suggest that it's actually America which is destabilizing the region, along with its partner, Israel, in that region. And Iran actually just is defending either the oppressed itself or trying to hold back these imperialists.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas from London there, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, thank you so much. From Marseille, France, journalist and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikaba Tahweh and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The United States is the only large, wealthy country in the world that doesn't have universal health care. The U.S. healthcare system ranks last among high-income countries. And the bad news comes when the media announces yet another drop in life expectancy in the United States for the second year in a row, which should be blamed mostly for the poor healthcare system in this country. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details on this issue. The title of the article is, "The U.S. Experiences Drop in Life Expectancy for Second Year in a Row." Stay tuned, please. Truthout website recently wrote, "Life expectancy in the United States has dropped for the second year in a row, a decline that is largely due to the coronavirus pandemic and the country's inequitable healthcare system. Before the pandemic, the average life expectancy in the U.S. was 78 years and 10 months. In 2020, that number dropped to 77 years, and last year, it dropped to 76 years and 1 month. The last time the nation's life expectancy was this low was more than two decades ago, in 1996. The current drop is the largest two-year decline in the U.S. in almost 100 years of tracking the data. The life expectancy for members of marginalized communities has undergone a particularly precipitous drop. Over the past 2 years, the life expectancy for Native Americans and Alaska Natives dropped by around 6.6 years. It's a ridiculous decline. When I saw a 6.6-year decline over 2 years, my jaw dropped. I made my staff rerun the numbers to make sure," said Robert Anderson, chief of Mortality Statistics Branch of the National Center for Health Statistics. The life expectancy for Native Americans and Alaska Natives is now just 65 years, according to the new numbers. This figure is equivalent to the nation's life expectancy overall in 1940s. According to the Truthout, these numbers were released in a government report recently which cited the pandemic as the central reason for the decline. But experts say additional factors played a role as other wealthy nations have not seen the same drops, and some have begun to see their life expectancies recover from declines brought on by the pandemic. Stephen Wolf, Director Emeritus of Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University, attributes the discrepancy to the fact that other countries have had more effective vaccination campaigns and populations that are more willing to social distance and wear masks. The U.S. healthcare system has also contributed to the decline, he said. While the U.S. is a world leader in terms of what kind of care it can provide, there are widespread socioeconomic disparities that make access to care more difficult, particularly for marginalized communities. Wolf said to the New York Times, "The United States is clearly an outlier. Notably, the U.S. is the only large wealthy country in the world without universal health care." And New York Times had this headline, U.S. life expectancy falls again in historic setback. It wrote, the decline during the pandemic is the sharpest in nearly 100 years, hitting Native American and Alaska Native communities particularly hard. The average life expectancy of Americans fell precipitously in 2020 and 2021, the sharpest two-year decline in nearly 100 years, and a stark reminder of the toll exacted on the nation by the continuing coronavirus pandemic. In 2021, the average American could expect to live until the age of 76, federal health researchers reported recently. The figure represents a loss of almost 3 years since 2019, when Americans could expect to live an average nearly 79 years. The reduction has been particularly steep among Native Americans and Alaska Natives, the National Center for Health Statistics reported. Average life expectancy in those groups was shortened by 4 years in 2020 alone. The culminative decline since the pandemic started, more than 6.5 years on average, has brought life expectancy to 65 among Native Americans and Alaska Natives, on par with the figure for all Americans in 1944. In 2021, the shortening of lifespan was more pronounced among white Americans than among black Americans, who saw greater reductions in the first year of the pandemic. According to New York Times, while the pandemic has driven most of the decline in life expectancy, a rise in accidental deaths and drug overdoses also contributed, as did deaths from heart disease, chronic liver disease, and diabetes. This is, until now, experts have been accustomed to measuring life expectancy changes in increments of months, not years. Even small declines in life expectancy of a tenth or two-tenths of a year mean that, on a population level, a lot more people are dying prematurely than they really should be, said Robert Anderson, chief of mortality statistics at the NCHS. But the coronavirus was not solely to blame. Long-standing health problems rooted in poverty, discrimination, and poor access to healthcare left Native Americans and Alaska Natives particularly vulnerable to the virus, said Dr. Ann Bullock, former director of diabetes treatment and prevention at the Federal Indian Health Service Agency and a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. New York Times says one in seven Native Americans and Alaska Natives has diabetes, the highest rate among racial or ethnic groups in the United States of America, and many struggle with obesity or excess weight. Both conditions make people more susceptible to severe COVID-19. And crowded, multi-generational housing adds to the risk. Americans suffer from what experts have called the U.S. health disadvantage, an amalgam of influences that erode well-being, Dr. Wolf said. These include a fragmented, profit-driven healthcare system, poor diet, and a lack of physical activity, and pervasive risk factors such as smoking, widespread access to guns, poverty, and pollution. The problems are compounded for marginalized groups by racism and segregation, he added. The result is a high disease burden among Americans and shorter life expectancy compared with that in comparable high-income nations over the last two decades, Dr. Wolf said. Over a million Americans have died of COVID-19 and more died in 2021 than in 2020, despite the availability of vaccines. To date, only 2/3 of Americans are fully vaccinated and only 1/3 have had a booster shot.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.